Cinemac Pass is like an I-5 corridor through into the Bering Sea and then out to Asia through the western side. And it's going to be something to keep an eye on for the times to come.
A pipeline project that would send more oil tankers through Alaska waters. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state's top military official supports working with Alaska's First People.
Every time we meet with the Alaska Natives that live in a particular region of the state, we learn something.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority would like to recognize businesses and organizations that employ Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions. When you hire a Mental Health Trust beneficiary, you're not just providing a job, you're providing an opportunity to showcase unique skills, a strong work ethic, and a desire to succeed. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Two brothers from the Dominican Republic have been sentenced for a drug and tax fraud conspiracy that authorities say could have exceeded $25 million. The U.S. Attorney's Office says Joel Santana Pierna was sentenced in U.S. District Court in Anchorage to nearly 12 years, and Abel Santana Pierna got 72 months. The men were also ordered to pay more than $550,000 in restitution to the Internal Revenue Service and forfeited $130,000 obtained in their drug trafficking scheme. They were charged with distributing cocaine in the Anchorage area. Prosecutors say they also conspired to use about 3,000 stolen Puerto Rican identities to file false income tax returns with the IRS. 10 others were charged. 4 have been sentenced. Others await sentencing, except one who is still a fugitive. Canada's Energy Board gave conditional approval earlier this month to the Northern Gateway Pipeline Project, which would run through British Columbia and would send hundreds more crude oil supertankers along high-traffic shipping lanes in Alaska waters. That means the Aleutian Islands will have to prepare for a higher risk of spills and accidents. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
The proposed pipeline stretches from Alberta, Canada, out to Kitimat, British Columbia on the coast. It would carry 520,000 barrels of diluted oil sands bitumen a day. Canada's National Energy Board said in mid-December that with some extra safety measures, they'd recommend that the government give the okay to build the pipeline. The Energy Board says tankers should have escort tugs as they head in toward the pipeline, but the board's recommendations don't cover what happens to the tankers when they're further out to sea. Leslie Pearson is the project manager for the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment. Their last vessel traffic study said that 11 crude oil tankers passed through the chain in 2008. If the new pipeline is built, Pearson says that number could spike dramatically to as many as 700 tankers a year.
You know, to see this group of vessels and the increased number of vessels that would be going through Unimak Pass, the Bering Sea, even as they make their way out of southeast Alaska, should have some cause for concern for both the United States and the state of Alaska.
Big tankers have had deadly accidents in the Aleutians in the past, like when the Selendang IU grounded in Unalaska in 2004. The ship had drifted and broken in two after losing power in Unimak Pass. It spilled about 350,000 gallons of fuel and some of its soybean cargo. Unimak Pass is a vital cut-through in the Aleutian chain. Even now, Pearson says it can be a choke point for vessel traffic.
It's quite wide, but if you're in a tug and barge, you know, and you got a big tank ship coming down on you, it can get to be a little nerve-wracking. Unimak Pass is like an I-5 corridor through into the Bering Sea and then out to Asia through the western side, and it's going to be something to keep an eye on for the times to come.
Gary Fawley of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation is helping with that. He manages the state's spill prevention and response program, and he's also part of the risk assessment team. Fawley says the issue isn't whether Unimak Pass can handle an increase in tanker traffic, but how it's going to handle it safely.
I don't think there's an upper limit. It's just as traffic increases, then so do the risks of having any kind of accident. The greatest threat we have are for drift groundings, where vessels lose power or lose steerage or whatever and gradually drift and ground.
The Selendang IU was 100 miles from Unalaska when it lost power. Leslie Pearson says some tankers travel as close as 5 to 20 miles offshore in the Aleutians. That gives them a dangerously short window to make repairs or be towed to safety before they run aground. The risk assessment team is looking at trying to route tankers further out from shore to give them more time to make corrections or be rescued. In the event of a spill, the Northern Gateway tanker's cargo would also be a concern. Folly says oil sands bitumen is heavier than regular oil, so it sinks faster, making it harder to clean up. And he says any kind of spill in the Aleutians is a challenge, even under the best circumstances. And that's probably not going to change.
You look at the size of Alaska and the remoteness of the Aleutian Islands, to place response depots all through the entirety of the Aleutian Islands then becomes extremely expensive.
That's why he says spill prevention is key. But there's another problem. Leslie Pearson says the Northern Gateway tankers wouldn't stop at an American port on their way to Canada from, say, Asia. That means U.S. and Alaska regulations, like those aimed at spill prevention, don't apply.
They're exempt from having a vessel response plan, being members of an oil spill response cooperative. They don't even have to meet the salvage and marine firefighting regulations for the United States either.
Pearson hopes they could design some kind of safety program for Unimak Pass that foreign vessels would want to buy into.
It's just going to be an interesting time to see how perhaps the U.S. government and Canadian government maybe talk through some of these issues and look at the downstream effects for large projects like this.
So far, she says there hasn't been much consultation. Pearson is focused now on the next round of risk assessment data, which is due out in January. And she says the team plans to make new recommendations on emergency management in the Aleutians by June. Gary Folly hopes all that will help them prepare for what he says is an inevitable upswing in vessel traffic, whether or not the Northern Gateway pipeline gets built.
You know, it's just a fact of life that the shortest distance between two points, between the West Coast and Asia, happens to run through the Aleutian Islands. And traffic is likely to increase, and this is just one of the ways that it could.
But nothing's for sure until the pipeline gets final approval, and that's a big if. Government leaders in Canada are facing a lot of opposition. They're expected to make a decision within 6 months. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
When Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel released the Pentagon's Arctic Strategy document last month, he said rapid change in the Arctic is leading to predictions of a tenfold increase in vessel traffic for the Northern Sea Route in the coming year. The Alaskan commander for the state's military, Lieutenant General Russell Handy, is tasked with coordinating and overseeing the implementation of the Arctic Strategy Plan. In part two of our interview with General Handy, he says funding has not yet been determined, partially because of uncertainty over how quickly Arctic climate conditions are changing.
We haven't gotten into a serious discussion of dollars because, quite frankly, I'm not sure we're in total agreement on that tenfold number. I mean, those are some predictions, but it seems like every time you pick up a paper, you read a new prediction on what the ice cap will look like, you know, in 5 or 10 or 20 years. And so, as I said, I do think you see cautionary tales in that strategy as well with regard to being very careful with an investment. And we do have infrastructure. If you look at our capabilities of our military bases between Eielson, Wainwright, and then even here at Joint Base Elmendorf Ridge, and the ability to project from there with our assets, we've got a fairly robust expeditionary capability from the air perspective. And the U.S. Coast Guard is actively involved all around the state of Alaska in the Arctic already. And so although we're watching very carefully the deep water port study that the Coast Guard is working with the state of Alaska on and some larger initiatives, I think in the near term, the Department of Defense would be satisfied with the infrastructure we've got. The farther term investment will be incumbent upon where we think the Arctic will be in that longer term.
Alaska doesn't currently have any real Navy presence. Under this strategy, how will that change in the next decade?
I think you'd be surprised if you looked, if you were able to examine off our shores how much Navy presence we actually do have. So the Navy does patrol in these waters, and they do a number of training events. They do an ICEX, and it's called ICEX, is well north of our shores, where they take a submarine up there and work together on a series of experimental things. And there's one scheduled this year. I've heard discussion that funding might preclude that, but that's a regular occurrence. They also do a number of activities within the Gulf of Alaska and off our shores. And so, although we don't have port presence, they do train and exercise regularly off the coast of Alaska.
What kind of growth and training exercises can Alaskans expect to see in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, as you know, we have a wonderful national resource of the JPARC, the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex. One of the areas I think you're going to see a notable increase, and we already have, is as our Army forces in U.S. Army Alaska come back from regular deployments to the Middle East, as we reduce our land component presence in the Middle East, they are actively jumping back into their Arctic skills, which have atrophied a bit over the years, based upon our many years of military activity in the Middle East.
Russian leader Vladimir Putin recently told a defense ministry meeting that his quote was, "Next year we have to complete the formation of new large units and military diversions in the Arctic that remain on constant combat alert." This seems to be in response to Canada staking a claim to the North Pole. Russia has already made a similar claim a few years back. How concerning is this for Alaska?
Well, in some respects, it's concerning because I think it depends on precisely what Russia means by, you know, combat alert and exercising of sovereignty. I think it's important that we all defend our national sovereignty and we defend our national interests. And certainly there are large portions of Russian national sovereign territory within the Arctic, as is Canada and the United States. When that extends into international waterways and into international airspace, I think that's where we need to come back to the table and have conversations and ensure we all have a common understanding of international norms. That said, we exercise regularly with the Russians. We regularly have events. We're talking actively to them about a more in-depth involvement in combined search and rescue activity, because it's such a large region. No one country is going to be able to be close enough to this entire region. So what we want to be able to do is to have a common understanding of how we're going to respond if we have a disaster or an overturned ship or a downed aircraft in the Arctic, so that we can help each other.
The U.S. has not ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty. How difficult will this make your work in the Arctic?
My assessment now is that it will have little to no impact, because we're essentially complying with all of the portions of that without having it ratified. And so I, practically, in day-to-day operations, it has no impact to me.
The eight Arctic nations, Canada, Denmark, Russia, Iceland, Norway, Finland, Sweden, and the U.S., comprise the voting bloc on the Arctic Council, a body that Secretary Hagel mentioned more than once in the document. Other nations, China for one, are pushing for seats on the Council as the world eyes the vast resource potential in the Arctic. How important is the Arctic Council in partnering on work in the Arctic?
As I said, I think the Arctic Council and organizations like the Arctic Council that support it are our center of gravity. The ability to sit down at the table together and collaborate as international partners will be the absolute key to our successful operation in the Arctic. As far as China goes, clearly our nation is very interested in an increased involvement with China on a global scale. We're very closely tied to China in every aspect of our national economy and our national interests. And so I won't speak for the Arctic Council on China's participation in it. I'll let them speak to that. But certainly we are always looking for opportunities to more closely engage and operate with China.
Multilateral training to enhance cold weather operational experience, will this potentially tap the knowledge resource of the people who have not only survived but thrived in the extreme conditions of the Arctic? Has thought been put into what the coastal native population could teach in this regard?
We have put some thought into that. And as I say, every time we meet with the Alaska Natives that live in a particular region of the state, we learn something about what they do and how we can interact better with them. So I believe the answer to that is yes. I think we're going to continue to learn from those who have been living and working in this state for generations.
Lieutenant General Russell Handy is the top officer in charge of Alaska's military. A full transcript of the entire interview is at our website, alaskapublic.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Sobering Center in Bethel works to keep drinkers safe.
When they're sober, they're just people. When they're drunk, they're just people with a problem.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
An effort to coax more Alaskans into getting a flu shot has prompted the State Division of Public Health to continue its fee waiver for flu vaccines. Free vaccines will be available at all state public health centers in Alaska for certain Alaskans. State-supplied vaccines are available at no charge to all children under the age of 3 and to anyone 3 and older who does not have health insurance. The free vaccines are also for people with insurance that does not cover vaccinations, or if they have not yet met their deductible. The $28 fee waiver is in effect through the end of March 2014. The state has confirmed 242 cases of the flu, mostly in the last 3 weeks. H1N1, commonly called swine flu, is the dominant strain this year, but protection against it is included in this year's vaccine. Bethel Sobering Center is now in its fourth winter of operation. It provides a safe place for intoxicated people to sleep off a bad night of drinking. Since it opened, the center has expanded its hours and built relationships with the people it serves. KYUK's Ben Matheson reports.
It takes a team to keep Bethel's inebriates safe. Community service patrol officers pick up people who are intoxicated and incapacitated. If they don't have a home to go back to, they're placed in Title 47 protective hold for 12 hours. At the Sobering Center, that means a night on a somewhat soft rubber mat. Last year, the center provided 1,860 sleep-off nights with about 970 unique people. Several make repeat visits. That's according to Rusty Tews, the Sobering Center program manager for YKHC.
We have a core of hardcore chronic users that we see regularly. They have a severe addiction problem. You know, they need more services than we provide, but they don't want them. You know, they're not ready to change. We have a core of binge drinkers. They'll come to Bethel maybe once in 3 months, and they'll spend 3 or 4 nights, and you won't see them for a year.
Two says more than half of the patrons come from surrounding villages. About 40% are Bethel residents, and the other 60 come from out of town. The visitors are not exactly in their best state, but Tews and the staff make an effort to avoid having too many repeat customers.
When people leave here, they're hungover. You know, a lot of them don't want to talk. But we do offer, a conversation. We provide basic health information.
Tews says about 1 in 5 are willing to talk about alcohol issues. Ultimately, 5 to 7% of the contacts result in a referral to medical treatment. The center started off being open just 4 nights a week, but later moved to a 24/7 operation. Two says the staff has learned to relax a little bit and meet people exactly where they are.
Everyone was terrified when we started that drunk people are nasty, ignorant, hard to get along with, and they're generally pretty just people. When they're sober, they're just people. When they're drunk, they're just people with a problem, and we've learned to deal with the problems in a sympathetic and professional way, and I think it showed.
In the future, Tews says the organization and its partners are looking into how to do more with the resources and better serve patients. I'm Ben Matheson.
The year that's about to end had more than its share of drama. As we turn the page on another year of news, APRN's Steve Heimel has a look back at some of the highlights with his list of the top 10 news stories of 2013.
What was big news in Alaska in some ways depended on where you were. If you were in Galena, it was flooding on the Yukon River in May. In fact, the river flooded again last fall as a storm surge sent high waters up the river all the way to Russian Mission from the Bering Sea. Also in the Bering Sea, the sea ice conditions were so jumbled that it was unsafe to hunt walrus, and both Gamble and Savunga on St. Lawrence Island declared economic disasters. And then in the fall, freeze-up was so late that they were harvesting bowhead whales in December. If you were in Bristol Bay, you had a particular interest in one of the biggest stories of the year when mining giant Anglo-American pulled its investment out of the Pebble Mine, and the other big investor, Rio Tinto, gave strong signals that the public opposition was likely to persuade it to pull out as well. You were also stunned by the death of an unarmed village public safety officer, Thomas Madole, who was shot in the line of duty responding to a person's home in Manicotic. And much of rural Alaska took an avid interest in a report by the Bipartisan Tribal Law and Order Commission that said the state government is not capable of maintaining law and order in villages from an urban centralized location and should be working with tribal courts. But there were some big news stories among the top 10 of the year that were spread all over the state. In Prince William Sound, two fishing tenders sank and spilled, and tenders also sank near Haines, Petersburg, and in Bristol Bay. Governor Sean Parnell continued an anti-federal thrust that included an investigation of a federal enforcement raid on placer miners, legal action on federal stream jurisdiction, and most notably, refusing to expand eligibility to Medicaid, even though the federal government would pay for it, denying health care coverage to tens of thousands of Alaskans. The oil and gas industry was heartened when the state legislature, at Governor Parnell's urging, changed the tax regime. But opponents of that change soon gathered enough signatures to put repealing it on the ballot. And hopes for offshore oil and gas prospects in the Arctic Ocean got a major setback when Shell's drilling rig Kulik went aground while under tow. Another big story still unfolding was the decision by major vendors not to sell Alaska salmon because it wasn't certified for sustainability by the Marine Stewardship Council. Sodexo changed its mind on that. Walmart is still on the fence. And rounding out the top 10 stories was a major plane crash at the Soldotna airstrip that took the lives of 10 people on their way out on a bear viewing trip. No probable cause has yet been released for that crash. I'm Steve Heimel.
If you were in southeast Alaska, the 5th of January 2013 brought a big scare when a 7.5 earthquake off Prince of Wales Island near Craig prompted evacuations in many southeast communities as tsunami sirens sounded. Fortunately, no large wave formed in the area.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com.
For the last 6 years, the Bristol Bay Environmental Science Lab has been collecting data about Nooshigak Bay. There is a lot that is known about the bay, but as KDLG's Mike Mason reports, there are still holes in the data.
The recent Southwest Alaska Salmon Science Workshop in Anchorage included a number of scientific presentations about Bristol Bay. However, the most entertaining presentation was more focused on what we don't know than what we do know. Todd Radenbaugh is part of the Bristol Bay Environmental Science Lab. He's an assistant professor of environmental sciences with the UAF Bristol Bay campus in Dillingham. He stressed several times that Nooshigak Bay is a very complex environment because it's a large, tidally dominated estuary. Estuaries are areas where freshwater meets saltwater. Radenbaugh lamented that many of the estuaries in the Bristol Bay region are not being systematically studied.
If you go down to the lower 48, they are studying them. They see that they're very important, but we'll see a little bit later. One of my theses, I don't think these models work up here, and we're sometimes applying them.
Radenbaugh and others with the Bristol Bay Environmental Science Lab have conducted sampling efforts at 10 stations during the summer since 2007, with an emphasis on water quality, shoreline erosion, and fauna distributions. Estuaries, by definition, are very dynamic systems because they're where different environments collide and mix. Radenbaugh noted that Nooshigak Bay has proven to be a fascinating estuary to study, in part because of the huge commercial fishery that intercepts large chunks of the sockeye salmon that return each summer to the Wood, Nooshigak, and Agushik rivers.
They're trying to go up, a good chunk of them are intercepted, and then they're spewed out in a different bits of pieces and parts, in a estuary. What are the implications of that major shift in this very important ecosystem? We got plenty of nutrients in there from the fish canneries, but are they the same size, are they the same form, are they the same degraded or non-degraded? We take the meat, we leave the guts and the bones, right? Well, you can say, well, maybe the meat was eaten up here by the bears, the fish, the seagulls. We don't know. Sounds like, to me, a nice good thing to study.
Radenbaugh was referencing the practice of nearly all of the seafood processors in Bristol Bay to discharge their waste fish products back into the various rivers. Specifically, he focused on the decision by the EPA to mandate that Trident Seafoods build a fish meal plant in Naknek, which could result in a significant decrease in the amount of waste products discharged back into the Naknek River. Radenbaugh says there should be some study of the impact of changing the amount of waste products discharged to make sure there are no significant changes to the productivity of the river. As part of his presentation, Radenbaugh noted that some organisms found in places like Bristol Bay behave differently than their counterparts in other areas.
Isopods here don't seem to function like isopods in the Baltic where they are studying them. There they go in the deep water for the summer. Here we catch them in the summer in the shallow water. Scratch, scratch, scratch. We don't know!
During the sampling efforts conducted each summer since 2007, Radenbaugh and his colleagues have collected samples of what he labels abundant summer species in Nooshigak Bay, including starry flounder, slimy sculpin, and bay shrimp.
Is it a commercial-scale shrimpery? I don't know! Could it be? I don't know. I don't think so. But it's certainly a heck of a lot of shrimp out there, and they seem to get bigger the further you go out. And what's in the coastal area? You get a little further out into the bay, well, these tend to be urehaline. They probably, the shrimp no longer are out there because I don't see in the NOAA reports a lot of these shrimp. So once again, they seem to be related to the urehaline waters.
The important data gaps outlined by Radenbaugh about the Nooshigak Bay estuary include winter ecology, seasonal changes of species, and the role of fish processing waste in the food web. Radenbaugh's presentation was part of the Southwest Alaska Salmon Science Workshop that was held in early December in Anchorage. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
If you're planning a celebration to bring in the new year, there are places in Alaska where you can blow off fireworks tonight, but not within the city limits of Anchorage. The municipality will sponsor a fireworks display this evening in the downtown area. City residents will face a citation and fine if they light their own firecrackers and bottle rockets. If you live in the Mat-Su Valley, you can shoot off your own fireworks from 6 p.m. until 1 a.m. Restrictions apply, including no pyrotechnics within 1,250 feet of a healthcare facility, school, or library. Also, not within 500 feet of any gas station or business where flammable fuels are stored. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Public Education Health Trust, formerly NEA Alaska Health Plan, delivers cost-effective health plans for Alaska families. They help Alaska's educational professionals, from school bus drivers to teachers, manage their health plan benefits efficiently. Public Education Health Trust provides members with low-cost plans, more choices, and local control, advocating for 17,000 Alaskans and their health care needs. This message sponsored by Public Education Health Trust.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.